Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate 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 Vasudevaya.
Chitraketurvacha.
Chitraketurvacha.
Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
Kim.
Kim.
Na.
Na.
Viditam.
Viditam.
Tapo.
Tapo.
Jnana.
Jnana.
Samadhivi.
Samadhivi.
Yogina.
Yogina.
Vasta.
Vasta.
Papana.
Papana.
Bahir.
Bahir.
Anta.
Anta.
Sharirishu.
Sharirishu.
So, I guess this is not written for you guys. So anyway, I'll just chant it one time. Chitraketaru vacha bhagavan king na viditam tapo jnana samadhi bhi yoginam dasta papanam bahirantak sharirishu. King Chitraketu said, O great Lord Angida, because of austerity, knowledge, and transcendental samadhi, you are freed from all the reactions of sinful life. Therefore, as a perfect yogi, you can understand everything external and internal regarding embodied conditioned souls like us. So this is the... There's no purport for this verse. There's no purport for the next verse either. Or the next verse. But... So, this is interesting. We were actually discussing this. I was discussing it with someone yesterday. I gave a seminar, in a sense, on this in Mayapur, related to this, and also then in Alachua. Because here, Angira is coming to Chitraketu as a great sage, Angira, and as a guru. So Chitraketu here addresses him as Bhagavan. O Lord. Bhagavan, with a long A, means the Lord, and then with a short A, Bhagavan, it's an addressing. Like in the Shikshastika, Lord Chaitanya says, Etadrishi tava kripa Bhagavan, which means addressing the Lord. So he asks a rhetorical question. Prabhupada states it as a positive affirmation that you can understand everything. In the Sanskrit, Chitraketu asks a rhetorical question and says, how is it not known? How is it not known by... how is it not known to the yogis who are freed of all sins, freed of sins by their austerity, knowledge, and samadhi? And how is it not known that which is going on outside and inside the embodied souls? Is there a little cottage industry back there or something? So, and then in the next verse, Chitraketu says, Tathapi prachito vruyam. Nevertheless, I shall speak to you because you're asking, Brahman, O Brahmana, Atmani chintitam, the cause of my anxiety, Bhavato vidushas chapi, even though you know these things, Choditas purananugyaya, but it's spoken. By your order, by your permission, I'll speak it anyway. So, this is, I guess, a topic I wanted to raise here, which I think is in direct relation to this verse, is the relationship between a spiritual teacher and disciples or subordinates or followers or students or learners or whatever, in the sense of the expectations, the different expectations there could be. And as we know, in any relationship, whether it's guru-disciple or marriage or whatever, if people have reasonable expectations and they fulfill the expectations, then there's a good relationship. Except in the case of people, perhaps whose taste changes or people are not very stable in their principles. But among good people who are stable in their principles, if there are reasonable expectations, and those expectations are met. So we can see very clearly in Prabhupada's own life that when Prabhupada first came to the West.
I'm sorry, Mars, we're getting class to look
down there. Oh, okay. I'll try that. What's that? Okay, we'll stop and let everyone stare at Seek. So, okay, stop staring at Seek. When Prabhupada first came to the West, he had certain expectations of what a disciple would be, and then he had to adjust those expectations. Prabhupada expected that when people made vows, they would keep them, that whether it was a marriage vow or an initiation vow. And I remember that Prabhupada was actually quite startled in the beginning of the movement when certain people not only didn't keep their vows, but may have sort of drastically changed their whole attitude toward things. And one example of Prabhupada adjusting his own expectations as a guru, or as a founder acharya, is regarding marriages. In the beginning of the movement, Prabhupada personally arranged a lot of marriages, and then, because he thought, okay, here's a boy who claims to be surrendered to me, here's a girl that claims to be surrendered, both of you say that all you want in life is to serve, so help each other serve. Then, anyway, it turned out that what Prabhupada soon realized, I don't know if he's realizing precisely these sociological terms, but when people have conversion experiences, very powerful experiences like that, for a certain period of time they may be very zealous and idealistic and all do anything, and then they kind of, this euphoria, spiritual, this ecstasy kind of settles down, and their human side resurfaces and they have to deal with it. So people made vows in the ecstasy of that new experience. They made vows they couldn't keep, whether they were marriage vows or initiation vows or just vows to do a particular service, like I'll go to this place and do this service. And so so from the point of view of the guru, there's learning to have more reasonable expectations based on, you know, where you are and who the people are and so on. And also, what is a reasonable expectation for a guru to have, for a disciple to have with a guru? We were discussing this last night. We went for a walk last night and I was discussing with some devotees. Because a devotee, I won't mention the name or the circumstances, or the names will be changed to protect the guilty. But anyway, the idea is that not my disciple, because I could never have a dissatisfied disciple. But a devotee was saying that his guru had given him certain instructions, not really philosophical instructions, not purely spiritual, but regarding some practical matters, and it turned out to be not good advice and caused some trouble in the devotee's life, and this affected the relationship. So, we talked about this. Were you there in Mayapur in any of those subversive classes? Hari Shori? Mayapur. We had a whole thing on this in Mayapur. I guess you weren't there.
In the night class or
in the auditorium there? I guess you weren't. Because I said we talked a lot about this. But, who is the guru? What is a reasonable expectation? What should a disciple think about the position of the guru? So there are several things to say about this. Of course, the simplest definition of a guru is one who is representing Krishna. Not only representing Krishna, but also, and equally importantly, the guru is representing the great acharyas. Prabhupada, in the sixth chapter of Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada, translating Rupa Goswami's teachings, says that the duty of a disciple is to follow in the footsteps of the great acharyas under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. So, a bona fide spiritual master does not create a new way of Krishna consciousness or create a path like, okay, now everybody chants so many rounds, or now this will be the sadhana, and so on, or now this is the mission. That is done by the great acharyas. As I say, acharya with a capital A. There's acharyas with a capital A and a small a. We all should be acharyas, but the great acharyas, as Prabhupada said, the ones who are really guiding the whole direction of Vedic civilization. The acharya is the one that actually establishes the way to serve Krishna in a particular age or in a particular historical circumstance. And then a bona fide guru is helping the disciples to do what the guru is doing, and that is to follow the acharya. So actually everyone is following the great acharyas, and among the followers of the great acharyas, naturally, those who are more experienced help those who are less experienced. And that's about it, I think. I think that's my simple understanding. As I sometimes say in this regard, that I just work here. It's just, you know, we're all following the great acharyas, and if you think about it, all of us, I'm sure everyone here helps other devotees that may not be as experienced as you in certain areas. I mean, there's probably hardly a person in this room that doesn't help someone to understand Krishna consciousness better. And so everyone is acting as a guru. Prabhupada expected everyone to be a guru. From Prabhupada's point of view, Prabhupada quoted, at least in the Veda base, Prabhupada referred about 200 times to the verse Jare Dako Tare Kala Krishna Padesh Amara Gya Guru Hoy Tare Desh, that whoever you meet, tell them Krishna's message, instruction, and by my order become a guru. Prabhupada really insisted that everyone should be a guru. Every man, woman, and, well, children also can be gurus. So what kind of guru we become, whether it's a Shiksha guru or Diksha guru or Vartna Pradarshika guru or whatever, that just depends upon your situation, the opportunities for service. It's just the circumstances. But actually, everyone is supposed to be a guru. Prabhupada, if you read what he says about this, Prabhupada considered that if you don't become a guru, you're being selfish. In other words, being a guru is not a trophy. It's not like a status symbol. Like, that's not what it's about. It's about being willing to sacrifice a little bit of my selfish time, time when I just do whatever I want to do, and actually help other people. So it's an act of giving. It's not acquiring a status symbol. It's just helping other people. And Prabhupada naturally concluded that if you are a good person, if you're a sincere devotee, then you should help other people. And if you help other people, then you're a guru. So that's one point. Another point is that in the guru-disciple relationship, to the extent that we are conditioned souls, to the extent a guru is a conditioned soul, I mean, we should be liberated. A guru certainly should be following the principles and practicing bhakti yoga, and if he or she is doing that, then that person is considered liberated, as also explained in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But even liberated souls may still be works in progress, as we know. It's like there are liberated souls and there are liberated souls. It's like Prabhupada wrote to Professor Stahl in that conversation back in 1970 that began when I approached him to try to get him to sponsor a class. He said, all my disciples are pure devotees. Meanwhile, back at the ranch. So what Prabhupada meant by that is that because they're giving their lives or following all the principles. So in a sense, one's activities are pure. It's very interesting because Prabhupada was in a sense somewhat behaviorally focused on what you were doing. Like if you have a good intention, you're doing the right thing, then fine. There's a tendency among certain people who I think are not the best and the brightest among us. There's a tendency among certain people, sometimes outside of ISKCON especially, to try to base spiritual qualifications on esoteric, non-verifiable criteria. In other words, my guru is the only pure devotee or something. At the present time, I think there's about 38 only living pure devotees on the planet. But Prabhupada actually gave us a spiritual science. And as I've been pointing out, we like to say that. It's like we get a lot of mileage out of that line. That this is not just another sectarian religion, this is a spiritual science. But if you want to use that kind of language, then you have to be prepared to back it up. As I've pointed out, that I feel like I want to say these things, but for me, and I've said them so many times, but that's okay. For those of you who heard this a lot, just hang in there. I'll eventually get to some new material. But anyway, the idea is that a spiritual science, any science, material or spiritual, indicates something, making claims which can then be verified and publicly verified. So if I say, for example, if I say, yes, actually last night I was dancing with Krishna and so on. And then, so my point to you would be, prove that I wasn't. Prove that I wasn't dancing with Krishna, or let me try to prove that I was. I can't prove that I was, you can't prove that I wasn't. And in this world, as P.T. Barnum said, a sucker is born every minute. I mean, it's not that hard to find some gurupi followers and form a little cult and so on. In fact, some people actually, they seem to enjoy this, like, you know, attracting sort of not very discerning disciples and then living in this little bubble. So if I say, like, if I say, yes, I'm a pure devotee, I'm with Krishna, I know everything, prove that I'm not with Krishna, prove that I'm not seeing Krishna, or how will I prove that I am? So this whole type of analysis, like I looked into the guru's eyes and I could see that, I mean, this whole type of thing is just not scientific. It's not scientific. Now, there's a statement by Prabhupada in his books where he says that the Uttamadhikari guru, or the first class guru, has three qualities. And what's interesting about these three qualities is they're all verifiable. They're not subjective. And therefore, these three qualifications can be part of a spiritual science. The threefold qualifications are the guru, well, not necessarily in this order. The guru should have a thorough knowledge of scriptures, really, like, really understand the scriptures and be able to present the scriptures in an expert way. The guru should be following, in other words, not simply know the scriptures, but actually practicing as well. And third, the guru should be a teacher. So if you take any one of these away, you've got a problem. If the guru knows the scriptures very well and practices, but is not inclined to really teach and help people, then how will this person teach you? If the person's not done, you know, the person just wants to live alone or do other things with his or her life. Or if the guru is a teacher and is practicing but doesn't know the scriptures very well, of course, then Prabhupada says it's a madhyam, it's a second class guru. So if your guru is teaching and practicing but just can't answer all the questions authoritatively or just is not that mature in scriptural understanding, that's a problem. Or if the guru knows the scriptures and teaches but doesn't practice, that's another problem. So from Prabhupada's point of view, if a disciple is dedicated to Prabhupada's mission, the disciple has really learned in a mature, realized way Prabhupada's books and practicing. It's like, God, what more can you ask of someone? What more can you ask of someone? And when did Prabhupada ever ask anything more than that? Learn my books, practice, and dedicate your life to teaching. And what more can you ask of someone? So if someone is doing that, there's no special qualification, like I have to be able to look in their eyes and I have to... Now, I would say among people who are following those qualifications, obviously you have to find someone that works for you. Not literally in the sense of the guru joins your company or something, but Jai Guru Dave, we're going to start you out in this department here. Gradually you can work your way up to a vice presidency. But works for you in the sense of has to be the right chemistry. One factor is that we bring a lot of baggage to our relationships. Some people are like really overweight. I mean, their baggage. So, for example, I mean, because I've been, actually, as I told someone yesterday, I've been doing this guru service, for good or ill, whatever, for half my life now. And people come into this relationship, like people, let's say they had a bad relationship with their father. And so, suddenly the guru becomes the father and all kinds of junk comes out. Or some people are very needy in other ways. Some people are very, there's all kinds of psychologies. Some people are completely, actually do better in separation because they don't fall into that familiarity breeds contempt, and they themselves need more independence and space. And so they actually flourish in a situation where they can just go out on adventures with the guru and bring back trophies. Some people need a lot of, you know, TLC. And some people really need to be taken care of, and they need a lot of attention. And there's all kinds of psychology. People just have different psychologies. And so a disciple has to find a guru that, I mean, not just to that somehow it works. For example, I remember in Los Angeles, one devotee approached me because this devotee had been aspiring, which is a standard ISKCON term, aspiring. It's a real funny thing. Anyway, it's Spanish. To aspire, aspirar, also means to vacuum like a rug. But it also means like to aspire to someone. So we all, I always joke that tell people to, you know, you have to aspire to carpet, Dave. Like when I ask them, it's Spanish, they always vacuum the rug. Anyway, one devotee was aspiring to this guru, and this devotee was sort of intellectual and wanted to study, and the guru was, you know, back that colleges are slaughterhouses. I mean, they are. But Prabhupada himself went to college and constantly used what he learned in college in his preaching. If you look at Prabhupada's preaching, he constantly used it. And he ordered me to stay in school. That was the first instruction I got from Prabhupada, to stay in college. So, I mean, gurus, every guru is not everything for everyone. Every guru is not everything for everyone. And it's a relationship. It's like, because someone's a nice devotee doesn't necessarily mean that'll be a good husband or wife for you. You have to find someone you can actually get along with a certain level that just and gurus also have different expectations. Some gurus insist upon a certain standard of, I don't know. You know, they want like very formal worship and everything, and some people actually don't. So it's just a relationship. It's a relationship, and it has to work on both sides. But then another point is the expectations regarding knowledge. And so Prabhupada was asked, I don't even know the reference, Jaidwaita Swami, I think they're walking on the beach in LA, and asked if the guru is omniscient, materially omniscient. It seems like Prabhupada kind of thought it was not like, what? Kind of, like, of course not. Only Krishna is omniscient. So if you think of our scriptures, Prabhupada told us that my qualifications are not concocting anything. There's no statement, any scripture I know, that to be a bona fide guru, you have to be like a rocket scientist and a chemical engineer. You have to know everything about the material world. It's just not. If you look at guru-disciple relationships in the scriptures, like Narada Muni would come here or there and inspire someone that accepted him as a guru, and he would give them some general program, like, in your life, I'd give them a sadhana. There are many cases where the guru gives a certain sadhana and then gives the disciple a mission in life. Think of Prabhupada's relationship with Bhaktisiddhanta. So that's what he talked about. Obviously, when Prabhupada accepted him, then Prabhupada took on a Gaudiya Vaishnava sadhana that Bhaktisiddhanta was teaching. And Bhaktisiddhanta inspired Prabhupada and gave him a vision and a mission. Like, you, in your life, you should do this. You should preach in the West, or preach in English. And Prabhupada was very inspired by that and made it his life's mission. He was very successful. I know the first letter I wrote to Prabhupada in 1969, when I joined the Berkeley Temple, I was a student at the university. I wrote asking whether I should stay in college or drop out, and Prabhupada told me I should stay in college. He said, I want you to be nicely educated so you can preach to similarly educated people. So that became my mission in life. And therefore, I tend to focus on certain things, or, you know, I'm famous for having certain, well, or infamous, notorious, for having certain views on things. And in my own completely self-justifying, self-flattering version of my own life, of course, I see that I'm actually trying to carry out Prabhupada's instruction. And the beauty of ISKCON is that there's so many of us, and every souls are unique, and therefore every soul, every member of ISKCON brings a unique understanding of Krishna consciousness and a unique way of serving Krishna. But in any case, speaking on this, because I just want to share some of my own realizations. Of course, if you say it's a realization, then it has to be true, right? So like I said, I share some of, this is what I tend to think about it, but then it might not, might be true or not, so I can say it's a realization. I mean, in my own life, I feel confident, I'm quite sure that I'm doing my job properly, well, basically, I mean, not all the details, but I'm acting as a guru in ISKCON, and I think, roughly speaking, I'm doing the job. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm expert at all material things. It doesn't necessarily mean I can give someone expert advice in certain psychological matters, or in certain financial matters, or in terms of vocational training. Like you absolutely have to marry this person, because what if it blows up in our faces? Even Prabhupada, I remember when I was temple president, Prabhupada wrote us a letter and said, I'm not doing marriages anymore. Because he just said, I'm out of there. Because he was doing a lot of marriages, and it was just all kinds of things were happening. So, I mean, a guru is expert daksha, or Vaishnava, one of the 26 qualities is daksha, expert, from which we have the English word dexterous, dexterity, but I think a big part of expertise is to know what you don't know. It's like Socrates, one of the early members of the Hare Krishna movement. Socrates, there's a famous dialogue written by Plato called the Apology, which describes the trial of Socrates. Socrates is brought to trial and trumped up charges. But anyway, at a certain, when Socrates is making his defense speech, and he notes that it was said of him that he was the wisest man in Athens. There was an island called Delphi. I think there still is a Greek island called Delphi. But anyway, there was an oracle there. There was a temple to Apollo, Surya. And there was a priestess, a lady priest, who attended Apollo, and people would ask questions, and then the answers this priestess gave were considered to be Apollo speaking through the priestess. So that was the oracle. And someone had gone to Delphi and asked, who is the wisest person in Athens? And the answer was Socrates. So Socrates then says at his trial, gee, I don't know why the oracle said that, but he said, maybe the reason is because at least I know what I don't know. And most of the people I meet pretentiously think they know what they don't know. So I think a big part of wisdom, a big part of expertise, is knowing what you know and what you don't know. And I think it's very important for a guru, how should I put it? I mean, we're supposed to be Shastra Chakshus. We're supposed to see through scriptures. And yet, there are certain elevated descriptions of Shastra that there's, you could say, I don't know if you want to use the word hyperbole, but there's, for example, the Phalashrutis, the fruit verses. Like, whoever reads this story will never be defeated in battle. So what happens if two kings both read the story? Or if someone accidentally fasts on a certain Ekadasi day, a flower airplane comes to Vaikuntha and takes the person away. even if they accidentally fast on that akara. And so as we know, the acharyas teach, well, this is not true for everyone, but it may be true for some. So there are certain ideal or idealized descriptions of a guru or of a disciple. They're ideal descriptions of husbands and wives. And as we know, in the real world, there aren't that many perfect husbands, there aren't that many perfect wives, and yet there are good marriages. There are good marriages because people at least are pursuing those ideals and measuring themselves against those ideals, and therefore they're good enough so they can have successful Krishna conscious relationships. So just as there are ideal descriptions of husbands and wives or little darling children and so on, so also there are ideal descriptions of gurus and disciples. The problem is, I think, or not the problem, but one problem can be, if a guru sees himself or herself or itself through, in terms of those highest descriptions, like, yep, that's me, and even if I don't always experience all those symptoms, I'll just write that off to humility. I guess the fact that I don't see all these exalted qualities of myself just shows that how humble I am. And then also another really interesting technique is you know those disciples who are most what's the word, flattering, most I don't want to say obsequious, but most reverential, you decide these are the real disciples, these are the ones that actually, these are, have faith in me. And then sort of in this Freudian sense of the superego, I as a guru, I can begin to see myself through the eyes of those people. I can surround myself by those who most flatter me and are most quote unquote surrendered, and then I can see myself through their eyes. And I, of course, filter out other views, no matter how accurate they are. So then I can get into a state of consciousness. I would never do such a thing. At least not at this age. So then what happens is I surround myself or with my circle of most flattering disciples. I read the most exalted descriptions of scriptures, and that's how I understand myself. And there's and then I can just be in denial about, certain, it's like everything I do which is not consistent with those high descriptions, it's just some kind of pastime or whatever. So people, denial, like just being, having an unrealistic view of yourself. Spiritual, religious societies offer the most extraordinary opportunities for hypocrisy. Because the higher the ideals, the more likely you won't meet them. And yet you can become attached to the ideals as self-descriptions because they're so flattering. So I think religious societies offer perhaps the best opportunity on earth for hypocrisy. And it's like Vyasadeva says in the it's like Narada said to Vyas in the, I think, the fifth chapter of the first canto, that namanyate tasya nivaranamjana. He said, Jagupchitam, that you've done a terrible thing because you've encouraged people in sense gratification, and once people experience that, they don't want to give it up. So once someone has tasted the nectar of being totally godlike, once someone has experienced the nectar of being exalted and worshipped, and you're just infallible, so even when you make mistakes, it's not really a mistake, and so on, it's a, it can be a thrilling experience. So once you've experienced this, a person may not want to give it up. They may not want to give it up. So, of course, even this is kind of like an extreme picture. Unfortunately, I don't think you have too many gurus in this con that go all the way in this type of delusion. But I think it can affect us. It can affect husbands. I mean, if you read descriptions about the Lord and Master of the home, Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And absolute power is nowhere so easily available as in a religious society. Because in a religious society, we claim to be representing God, and often we actually do represent God. So, and Krishna is actually the absolute authority. I remember, I just tell one little story. I've told this before, but anyone here remember the Andy Griffith Show? For those of you who don't remember it, 25% of your life is wasted. But anyway, there was this guy, Barney Fife. You remember that? Barney Fife was the assistant to the sheriff. And he's Don Knotts. He's real nervous, skinny little guy, real nervous. So they only gave him one bullet, and he had to keep it in his pocket. Because whenever he put the bullet in the gun, it would just go off. He couldn't control himself. I forgot what I was going to say now. I so much got to talk about the Andy Griffith Show. What was I saying before that? Oh, my God.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah, okay, I remember now. So, just like Barney Fife, as soon as he put the bullet in his gun, went off. I remember the first time I was actually given real authority in the Hare Krishna movement. I'd been in the movement a long time, then about 2 months. And a couple other guys joined, so naturally I knew everything, they knew nothing. And one time I was told to walk them down to the Sankirtan party, which was 2 blocks away on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley. And I can remember that as I walked out the temple door, these two guys, and they were under my authority. It was almost like werewolf under the full moon or something. I felt this incredible surge, to use a contemporary word, suddenly all this absolute authority, and I think in the first block of our walk, I probably gave them at least 15 instructions. We were just walking one block down the street, but at a certain point they turned to me and said, what are you doing? That was a Barney fight. So if you think about it, there's a term in the Bhagavatam which is apadharma, which means emergency dharma. I give a simple example. God, I'm too tired today, so I guess I'm just giving, these are all reruns, but. Anyway, let's say one day you look at your neighbor's house and the house is on fire. And let's say you know that there are children sleeping in the house and the parents are gone. So what you do is obviously you break into the house. If you have to take an axe and chop the house, the door down, or break the windows, you get into the house and take the children out because it's an emergency. Now let's say there is no fire and you just break the windows of your neighbor's house and take their children out. You're going to be up the Vaitarni River without a paddle. So obviously when there's an emergency, then the Bhagavatam, Vedic culture was not, they were practical, they were real people. So therefore in the Bhagavatam, several times you'll find the statement that a person should never do this, anapadi, if it's not an emergency. So there's this category you find throughout the Shastra of apadharma, your duty in a time of emergency. So, in my view, looking at the history of ISKCON, those of us who are in the first generation, the fact that Srila Prabhupada gave up his physical or his external presence in this world when we were very young I think we took on type of apadharma. I think it's not at all normal. I know when Prabhupada left, I was 29 years old. Had been in the movement 8 years and suddenly became God on earth. So, actually, I should have called myself Bhumipad. clay feet. But anyway. But so this was that was normally, if you were designing the ideal spiritual society, you wouldn't put 29-year-old people who have been in practicing 8 years, you wouldn't put them in the kind of position I was in. Even when Prabhupada called me to his room and asked me to be the GVC when I was 25 of Latin America, I was sent down to take charge of the lives of men, women, and children at the age of 25, and I've been living 4 years at that point. So all these things at such early ages, taking on such immense responsibility and authority, I think was just a very special situation. In normal human societies that have been around longer, people at a more advanced age take on those types of duties. So in any case, so any questions so far on these points? I've been bringing up different points. Yes, Harishori Prabhu.
Well, I'm just thinking that, you know, you were talking about the guru-disciple relationship, but then the complexity of that within an institutional framework, that adds another dynamic to it.
Yes, yes.
Which is, again, something that's had to be learned.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, you can't really take that from any Shastra, you know, the practicalities of that. You were saying that, you know, there's some verifiable qualifications. But then the application, you know, according to the circumstances, it becomes infinitely more complex, you know, when you've got a society like ISKCON, where you have no reference points in one sense.
Although, if we look at, well, Vedic culture as it was functioning in ancient times, I think there was definitely a sense of, how should I put it, law and order. In other words, the guru couldn't just do anything. In fact, there's one amazing story, I think it's the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam, the Kalmashapad, stained foot. He had stains on his legs or feet or something. So anyway, King Stainfoot, where his guru, Vasishta, cursed him, and he counter-cursed his guru. So it was like gunfight at the Acha Goshala. Okay, Corral. So anyway, if we look at, there was tension. And there's a story in the Mahabharata, amazingly enough, where the kings kill all the Brahmins. So, I mean, there were definitely tensions. And, well, getting back to your point, I think gurus operated within a very explicit, very somewhat demanding cultural context. So the idea of the freewheeling guru that can just sort of do anything, I think is something, I think it's almost a modern phenomenon. Because in modern times, there's secular society, there's democracy, there's diversity, there's religious freedom. So in India especially, for example, I think it's a combination of two historical factors. Number one, the fact that in India, with some exceptions, like the Madhwas, and you don't always have these heavy religious institutions like the churches in the West. Although to some extent they do. There was a lot of freedom. But then you get a situation of great diversity. So you don't have the cultural pressure of sort of a traditional society, nor do you have a heavy institution, so it's like the guru can do anything. And then you get these really totally out of control so-called gurus, who are, you know, some of the most famous one actually had the most disciples in India, trying to be a homosexual pedophile. And some of his followers still think he's God, because that just shows God can do anything. So I think it's a combination of those factors. But if you go back earlier in Indian history, I believe there was a tremendous amount of cultural pressure. And gurus that were too eccentric. I mean, an example of that is, say, Judd Bharat. His father, Rishabhdev. Original. If you look at Rishabhdev, he was certainly a sage, but because he acted eccentrically, people attacked him. And the same thing with the Avantipur Brahmin. Because he was, he was just harassed everywhere he went. People even made fun of Shukadev Goswami because he was wandering naked. So what we find is that there was very serious cultural pressure to conform to certain standards, and even sages and Brahmins and gurus that didn't conform were often harassed, even physically harassed. I think it's more the modern thing, where you don't have a heavy institution nor the cultural pressure, and, you know, throw in a heaping tablespoon of Ramakrishna, do your own thing, and you get this out of control pseudo-Vedic culture where the guru can do anything. Yes.
So is that why, you know, his name is Bhishma, terrible vow, because he changed his...
Yeah, Bhishma also means awesome.
But is there some correlation between that? I mean, that we should stick to our duty?
Well, it was unnatural. Bhishma did it because he was in an extraordinary situation. He had been cursed and so on, and so somehow... I mean, if you look at the Mahabharata, there's all kinds of extraordinary situations. People being born out of pots, like vessels like Drona. Dr. Vessel. That's what his name is. Dronacharya means Dr. Vessel. Or another great one is Professor White, Shukracharya. That's what his name is. So,
5 more minutes.
Okay, any other question? Any ladies? Yes, Kamalini.
You know how at the age of 25, after being a devotee for 4 years, you're able to do such extraordinary service. So still, you had that kind of shakti and, you know, that spiritual strength. So it didn't just come from nowhere. And it seems like now, even if someone's older, that's the main ingredient, isn't it? Like, where did you get that strength?
I sent in some cereal box tops. No, it's true. I mean, it's true. Prabhupada also said to me that the main thing is enthusiasm. At the same time, I see in retrospect that if I had been more mature and enthusiastic, then I could have avoided certain problems for myself and others. But yes, you're right. We have to be enthusiastic. And even those of us who are now members of the American Association of Retired Prabhus, AARP. I mean, it's a very good point you brought up. We do have to find within ourselves that Prabhupada, we have to find Prabhupada. And that extraordinary enthusiasm, that dynamic, relentless will to spread this movement, and you do it in a mature way. It's like a dialectical process. The thesis was sort of this unbridled enthusiasm, take no prisoners, kill the demons. And then there's sort of a reaction to that, and everyone wants to settle down. And then what we need is a synthesis where we have all that enthusiasm, that love for Prabhupada, and the confidence that Prabhupada gives us. You know, feeling Prabhupada's confidence within us, and that dynamic spiritual energy. At the same time, being mature and wise and intelligent. So that is the most powerful combination, enthusiasm with wisdom. Clock is ticking. Yes.
There is only guru that teach art of living.
They teach what?
Art of living.
Art, the art of living. Yes.
Prabhupada teach art of dying.
I think he also taught the art of living. I mean, sometimes we do other things besides die. So back there, the lady. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they published all, you know, the recent, everything, you know, in particular, I was looking at their cult books, and I found it fascinating that in none of the recent cult books were the Hare Krishnas included.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And,
Oh, that's good.
They're not considered, they didn't have cult status anymore.
Very good. Well... Well, anyway, on the one hand, it's a loss of status, but try to make up for it in other ways. Thank you. That's very good. So, anything else? Yes, Bharadraj? Is that time? Well, hold that thought, Bharadraj. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.